Okay. Yes, we're now on the UK Transparency Board, which was a bit of a sort of political fix that I decided that I was going to retire when I owned one of David Cameron's pet projects, which was to introduce transparency and open data into government. And how do you retire without it being seen as a disagreement with government policy? And the answer is that you get yourself put on the advisory board. So you've still got that continuity of policy. You get to kick your successor at regular intervals, and you don't have to spend all day arguing with Cabinet Office, Finance and HR, which actually means you spend more time on the interesting stuff. On the other hand, you don't get paid. So that didn't work out very well. So sort of what I'm going to talk about, just a bit about the world of open data and what's been happening over the last 2-3 years, what the policy drivers for the UK government have been in doing this, and some of the history of various reports and studies and white papers that have done that. Some work that I'm currently doing on trying to gather some of the emerging business models for open data, particularly on what's happened in the UK, but we'll talk a bit about models elsewhere, which is starting to get quite interesting. A bit about how data.gov.uk was developed, not a conventional IT project, not a conventional government IT project. As far as possible, not an IT project. But I'm not going to get into advanced programming, so anything more advanced than Fortran 66, I'm the wrong man. Some of the lessons learned along the way, which, again, aren't about programming, but about pushing these sorts of change through government, and some of the wider implications. And I think the wider implications may be of particular interest to this group because it's about how government uses data and the role of data in the national economy and so on. And then I'm yours for a discussion. So the world of open data. February 2009, Tim Berners-Lee gives this famous TED Talk in California, which are limited to 15 minutes, as you know. So he's ever seen Tim talk, you know, it takes him a while to get going, but finally has them all chanting, you know, raw data now, raw data now. And this was really the launch of the open data move. Berners-Lee seeing this as the way of kick-starting the web of data to follow the web of documents. Actually, if you look at his original proposal for what became the World Wide Web, it is actually a semantic web because the links have a meaning to them. And that's very clear from that original 1991 diagram. Obama came into office in January 2009 with a commitment on opening up some of the federal government information, particularly, and the first out of the trap was the stimulus package, the $788 billion. And Obama pledged to have a website which showed where every cent was spent. This has proved a bit of a problem for the US government, and it turns out that the reporting of the information by the various states and cities who were given the money ranges from shoddy to worse. And so it really has brought out some data problems. But the US government have pushed away on that. In the US, apart from obviously classified information, there's been much more culture over the years of data paid for by the taxpayers is in the public domain anywhere. That's not the case in Europe. But in the UK, we've had data.gov.uk launched originally under Gordon Brown's leadership, then very much enthusiastically taken up by David Cameron. Australia have got going, but then they've had a bit of a pause, and it really hasn't caught the political will there. The World Bank have opened up all their sort of statistical repository, which is quite interesting stuff. It's not actually raw data, but they have normalized statistics about a whole set of countries and very wide range of indicators, and that's all available from the World Bank. Cities have got into it. There's a London data store here in London, the greatest achievement of which was to open up the data from Transport for London on tubes and now buses, which Transport for London didn't want to do. But when Boris launched the London data store, someone asked about TfL data, and he said, of course that will be free. So it's now free. Vancouver in Canada, a particularly good city. Rennes in France, first off in France, but a number of other French cities have done it now. And just before Christmas, the French government launched an open data site. San Francisco have done a lot, some good stuff on transportation there. Kenya is first in Africa, mainly statistical data, but some quite interesting sort of comparative between the various regions that wasn't really visible before. And overall, now over 200 governmental open data sites around the world. Most of them have statistical data. In the US, you get quite a lot of event-level data or real-time data. In the US, you get things like individual crimes, sort of, which the Chicago crime map was the first of those. We've now got that sort of in the UK. I did some work for the New Zealand government on what people actually do with this open data. And there is a surprisingly large minority of users who actually use it for further analysis. So further on, I'll give you a tale about UK official statistics on this. What's driven the UK government on this? Really, three drivers came together. I'll just do these in the order that they've been running. In 2007, the government commissioned Tom Steinberg of My Society and Ed Mayo, then with the National Consumer Council, to do a report which became known as the Power of Information. And some of it was about, you know, the government should use Twitter and go on Facebook and those sorts of things and take part in online conversations, which are happening, whether the government likes it or not. And Tom Steinberg did the bit which says the government's got all this information that it gathers, it needs for its own purposes, and it should make that information available, because other people will think of other interesting things to do with it that the government either can't think of or couldn't afford to implement. And that will lead to economic growth and social growth and social cohesion. And that was taken forward by a Power of Information task force that had a competition called Show Us a Better Way, which was intended to bring out some ideas about how government data would be used. And actually it resulted in some applications being built where they could get the data, some example applications being built saying, and just give us some data. And famously, there was one about, where's my nearest post box? So it turned out the post office, the Royal Mail, don't know where the post boxes are. The list of post boxes was beaten out of the Royal Mail under the Freedom of Information Act. And a guy called Matthew Somerville developed a crowdsourcing site that over now 3 years, over half the post boxes have been geolocated by the British public, including all those in TN13 and TN14, which I did with a GPS and a bit of sort of urban orienteering or rural orienteering as well. And it was a bit of a puzzle because the post office list. If you look at the list, the numbers are a bit mysterious. The first bit is actually the postcode of the collection office that collects from it, not where it's located. So they don't actually have a postcode for the post boxes. And the sequence numbers, if it's a low one, they're on the original van route. So if it's in the sort of tens or twenties, and you're trying to find one, if you know where the one before and the one after in the sequence are, then you can take a guess. But latterly, they've started to add just sort of random numbers. Anyway, it's locating post boxes on Matthew Somerville Dracos's site, and under this government, the use of data has become a major part of the growth review, the second phase of the growth review. And that led to the announcements in November about freeing up more data, and particularly some of the sort of big data that I'll explain in a moment. The EU are now on the act on this. About 10 years ago, they had a directive on public sector information, which didn't have any requirements to make public sector information available to the public, or to make it available free. All it required, and this was a sort of open single market directive, was that it should be on non-discriminatory terms. So if you're prepared to give it to a business in your country, you shouldn't refuse it to a German or a French or a British company. But the economics on this that have been done estimates in a sort of direct business gain of about 40 billion euro across Europe is available. And when you add in the consumer surplus of this, you know, how much is worth citizens not to stand in the rain waiting for a bus that's not going to come for a long time, that adds up to about 140 billion. And there's a certain amount of smoke and mirrors with these figures, but as Graham Vickery says, even if they're out by 50%, they're still large numbers, particularly as the cost and revenue foregone of releasing this is likely to be about 1 billion. So it's quite leveraged. Well, some of it is charged. Some of it is charged for. So if you make it free, you probably sacrifice that revenue. That's not strictly automatic, because sometimes you're providing both the data and a reliable service to serve that data. So if you're serving it through an API and you want a certain response rate and a certain level of reliability, then there's the cost of that, and it's worth it. If it's just a raw data download, then you wouldn't get any money for it. Many agencies have a sort of phantom revenue in mind of what they think they might get on this. Some agencies, including one that released its data in November, when we really probed, it turned out the costs of selling this information were more than the sales revenue they got in. So they're actually making a loss by charging for this. Because small charges, expensive. Anyway, a lot of money in this. About half a dozen business models developing here. One, this is Spike Scovell, an early mover in this space. They take the item-level spending data that every local authority, except for Nottingham, now publish every month. They clean it up, which means applying standardized supplier codings, which public agencies don't have. So Spike Scovell have to put that in. They do some adjustment of categories and the like. And they sell that as business intelligence to suppliers to the public sector, and interestingly, they sell it back to local government on how that local authority is doing and the prices it pays compared to what other local authorities are paying, and which firms are active in the market besides the one that local authority is using. The aim has been to avoid doing legislation. Nottingham refused. Eric Pickles himself has put in a Freedom of Information request to Nottingham to get this data on the basis that 399 other local authorities can do it. So there can't be a reason that Nottingham can't do it. And I'll come on to that. Information service to the public, weather, transport, and public facilities. You know, where's my nearest? You know, the classic sort of public toilet application are among the most downloaded smartphone apps. Hong Kong, who aren't big on transparency, interestingly, just released this sort of information, transport and public facilities information, to just kickstart the Hong Kong application market. Data mining getting underway and a key part of the growth review. The vast amount of data in the health service that can be some combination of anonymized and held in a walled garden that you can then analyze and find interesting and financially rewarding things in there. So about prescribing data, about longitudinal health records and patient outcomes. And there's also the suggestion on pupil-level education records of what you can get from mining that. And you know, government's view is, you know, let's actually get that data made available so economic value can be extracted from it. Sorry? Well, I think it's more about, you know, individual records. So, you know, which are the drugs that aren't actually making much difference and which are making difference. I think Mark Walpolt read and said, you know, one of the classic cases where this had been worked was the linkage between low dosage of aspirin and avoidance of heart attacks, which was found by this sort of data mining. Another area is sort of operational efficiency, optimization of logistics and the like, so roadworks information, traffic flow, real-time traffic flow information, and even some of the sort of historical ones, which ITO did, in showing where pinch points are developing on the motorway network. Indeed. I think it's called the Strategic Road Network. So it doesn't have. Well, so Scotland is odd. It doesn't have the A303 on it. Financial products. This historically have been a big area in the U.S. with a large private weather industry, because the weather forecasts for a long time in the U.S. have been made, and basic observation data have been made freely available. But also there, they grew a market in financial derivatives, weather derivatives and financial products that allowed you to offset the lay off the risk of bad weather at quite a detailed level for farming or for construction. And Lloyd's here are very interested in that. They're also very interested in improving flood insurance through very detailed topographic and river records. Because at the moment, for unusual floods, its properties is done on claims history. So you're actually charging higher premiums on those unlikely enough to have a once in 100-year flood, and not sharing that risk with those that haven't had a flood in the past couple of decades, but are actually vulnerable. Quite a bit of using data for attract customers in and retention. So there's land registry data, which the government's now going to make free, on how much has been paid for each house that's been conveyed since 1995. Is there a sort of magnet to track people in? You see on this site, the Zoopla one, you've got links for estate agents, links to financial services, links to builders and other local services. And we also see in the social sector the people using government data as information people want, and then they hang community action, community activism around that. The data will be free on the 1st of March, as I recall, because all this data was being bought on a 3-month rolling contract. And if there's one thing which was harder on the finance people than making it free, it was giving refunds to those who had already paid. So we gave notice to people who are buying this that from the 1st of March this year it will be free. 37 gigabytes of Ordnance Survey data are already free, including most of that people had asked for general purpose applications. So the postcode file, which allows you to take a postcode and basically get a location from it, the National Gazetteer, digital maps for 1 to 50,000 and 1 to 25,000, and in towns, raster maps for 1 to 10,000 have all been made free, and a number of other products, including the coarse topography, which doesn't change very much. The topography down to whatever it is, five centimetres or 10 centimetres, which does have to be resurveyed quite frequently, particularly in East Anglia and various flood places, that's still chargeable. So basically on the Ordnance Survey now, and this has been the case since 1st of April 2010, the low resolution data, of which there was a very wide set of users, but relatively low charges, is free, and the high resolution data, of which there are a limited number of users at the moment, most of which are 800 pound gorillas, that's because they're either government departments or utilities, and they are developers, in some cases developers, that's still charged for. And it's actually that higher resolution data that drives, maintains the quality of the, if you like, the lower resolution data. So we're running with that hybrid model, and that's what you're starting to see in the recent announcement about the Met Office, that the what's always been known as the Public Weather Service, although it wasn't available to the public. So the forecasts that are in the BBC and the newspapers and the like, and the basic observation data are now freely available. If you want a specialised forecast, sort of Marks and Spencer's wanting to know whether to how much salad to stock for a summer weekend, which depends on what the weather's going to be, then that's a chargeable service on top, chargeable advisory service. On ordnance survey data, where local government still and central government still actually pay, but because the product structure is now much simpler, and there's master map and the free products, whereas the previous arrangement with each local authority, each government department, where they chose what particular products they were going to take and had a tailored price, now there's one price for everyone, and it's as much as you can eat, and that turns out to have a important consequential benefit, that you, if you're a local authority, you can share your data with another local authority without worrying about derived data issues, because or how they're going to visualise that data, because you know that they've got rights to the data, to the Ordnance Survey data they need. And the Ordnance Survey free data has been taken into OpenStreetMap and used to improve OpenStreetMap. The Ordnance Survey Open Space platform, because even for the still chargeful data, they changed their charging model. Previously, if you had a business idea, before they would even allow you access to the data to do any development, you had to describe your idea in detail, and the Ordnance Survey would decide how much they would charge for the data based on how profitable they thought your business would be. Now they've completely, and largely they saw their customers as large existing customers. You concentrate on the customers who are paying a lot of money. Actually now they concentrate on the customers who are going to grow businesses, they're going to generate revenue into the future. So the open space platform for developers is free. You just have to sign the development agreement, and you can develop to your heart's content. And it's only when you want to go into production that if it's chargeful data, you have to have that conversation with the Ordnance Survey now. Social value and cohesion. This is on the right-hand side here. You know, using data doesn't necessarily require digital products. You can end up with a hyper-local newspaper, which this is called the postcode paper, just draws data in from different databases. And on the left here, Stoke-on-Trent, use data as a sort of magnet to draw people to this Pits and Pots community journalism and community activism site. So that was the economic growth thing, but in the UK, data has been seen as also important for improving public services by both the previous government in the Smarter Government white paper and in the Open Public Services white paper. And I think the classic example of this is police crime maps. The first attempt of this being not very useful. The second, bringing out individual crimes, locations. Some police have complained that this has altered policing priorities, because people have been concerned about the amount of specific types of crime in their area. And actually, that's been both government policies towards more neighbourhood policing, rather than dashing around in cars with blue lights flashing. And so evidence that that's doing it. You get some few data issues sort of come through. So there's this village in North Yorkshire. You have an enormous number of thefts. And that turned out to be crime, real crime hotspot. And that turns out to be thanks to the British Transport Police, that if there is a theft on the train from London to Edinburgh, they're required to geocode it. So they just put it on the midpoint between London and Edinburgh. One of the things in version 2 of the police crime maps system is that the crime page has on it how to contact your local neighbourhood policing team, how to get in, where to sort of follow them on your local police force on social media, and how you can get involved in local consultations on crime and policing. So they're actually using it as a sort of magnet to get the public more involved. The third policy driver, transparent, accountable government, which was actually what was the tipping point in doing this. And it was the MP's expenses scandal and the feeling in the Brown government that they needed to do something pretty quick on transparency of government before Heather Brooke turned her attention on the government. And so as part of a package of measures about greater transparency in government, which included changes to the Public Records Act and the like, Gordon Brown announced the work that led to data.gov.uk. The coalition government, there's a chapter in the coalition agreement on transparency, and that's driven the release of senior civil service salaries, spending by individual agencies, openness in contracts and invitations to tender, and organisational diagrams. The certain sector of the press had a bit of field day on this. I wasn't one of the 172. Indeed, the very few of the 172 were actually permanent secretaries. And they were mainly, there's a large bunch of them who were chief information officers or chief technology officers brought in from the private sector, paid more than the head of the department, and a quite interesting set of people. And certainly, if you set the threshold at 170,000 rather than 150,000, very few permanent secretaries would have been in there. And some questions about how the system sort of works. We've now taken it to it's now done not by level of salary, but by seniority of the post. So directors, the basic tends to be about 80,000, and above are all visible now. There's a tool, I haven't got the link here, where you can search all these departmental records for keywords. Yoga and wine are worth a go. Massages also work. There's real-time energy monitoring data of the government headquarters buildings, which is only a very small part of the government estate, which somebody took and analysed. Basically, do departments switch off their lights and computers at night? And luckily, the Department of Energy and Climate Change, nighttime, which is beginning and end of this, is quite low. The Ministry of Defence say, oh, well, 24-hour department and all that. But it doesn't quite explain why the Treasury are so high at night. Indeed, there's less variation through the day. And there's Openly Local, which takes a whole set of local government sources and does a sort of dashboard by local authority, compares. And we've seen the sort of data journalism start to come through. The coins data from the Treasury, 24 million lines. The normal journalists had a bit of a problem with this and was sort of critical of it in the first 24 hours, because when you try and download a 24 million line CSV file into and launches Excel on your laptop, no, this is bad. This is bad. But the Guardian data team, who are very, very good, just took this, and within 48 hours, they built a navigator for this data, so you could filter it and sort it and amalgamate it. And then in another 24 hours, 10 specialist journalists from the Guardian had each written a story about something, about the area, you know, defence, public finance, health, that they had found in this data that they'd not known before. So, for instance, one of the things was how much the government writes off each year in bad debts and who's doing the write-off. And it's all there in the paper accounts that are laid before Parliament by individual department, but this is the first time that it had been publicly aggregated. I think what we are seeing is that the sort of shock horror name of the highest paid civil servant. You know, it's shock horror when it first comes out. But then, you know, the popular press move on to some other subject. What we are seeing is that the data journalists are not driven by the release of data. They're driven by things they become interested in. And then can they find data that allows them to track that down? So one of the data journalists at The Guardian said to me, you know, it's almost sort of like the IRA's message to Margaret Thatcher, you know, we just have to be lucky once. You know, you have to be lucky all the time. You put out all this data and don't expect us to write about each bit of data, but we'll choose what we're going to write about and when we're going to write about it. Open data is like the Freedom of Information Act was supposed to be, which was largely government departments and other agencies putting out information, and the right to ask for information being just a safety valve for that. In fact, what's developed over the last 10 years is that most agencies just put out some form of annual report, which is pretty bland, and some official statistics, which just continue. And then anything else you have to ask for. And that's much more expensive to administer, and they doesn't necessarily lead to the best balance between the public right to know and sort of private space to take decisions. So, and one of the things that some talk about now is sort of FOI 2.0. And the Information Commissioner himself has said if an agency is more open in terms of the information it routinely makes available, then he'll tend to give a greater weight to their arguments why on a specific case some additional information shouldn't be published in that balance of information. If their policy is to give nothing away unless it's demanded, how can he be sure they're taking a reasonable decision on any access request, because they haven't really gone through the process with their information? And so he's talked about Chris Graham has talked about FOI 2.0, and I think we should get that. Not me talking, so I'm well behind. Data.gov.uk had a bit of small central team, four people, short stages, each with clear goals, respond quickly to feedback from users, and indeed one of the early things was actually getting some prospective users of the data in terms of developers engaged, drawing resources from the government's own experts. This is also a sort of consultant-free zone. Each data set was always controlled by its owner. So the agency owning the data is the one who formally took the decision to release and had custody of it throughout. So actually data.gov.uk doesn't hold data. It holds metadata and has search tools that then point to data that surfaced typically on departmental websites, but some of the larger data sets are held in cloud storage and the like. And it's not primarily an IT project, so we kept the IT very simple. I'll skip through some of this. But in the first 2 years, over 7,500 data sets. The UK custom is a very conservative counting rule. So the US data.gov has over 300,000 data sets, and over 300,000 of those are geospatial shapefiles. Well, in the US, it's files. In the UK, it's data about a sort of thing, and often a national collection. And so the Ordnance Survey free data is actually 10 data sets in the UK, whereas for the US, it's over 300,000 files. And it's 37 gigabytes of geographical data. Along the way, it's been important to have top-level political support. Both recent prime ministers. The UK has been privileged to have a very strong demand side. Civil society groups like My Society, who are sort of using technology for civic activism and useful products, particularly the data team at the Guardian, both using data and campaigning. And then, one of the Guardian people told me that the Guardian has only ever had two campaigns, abolish the monarchy and open up government data. And Lloyds and other potential commercial users have been quite active in this, and the Open Knowledge Foundation based in Cambridge, although they're international, have been very influential. And if you're going to get anything done in Whitehall, then you need a pretty passionate team. There are more than four there, but this is actually a larger team, but it's all wearing our Raw Data Now t-shirts. We didn't try and map out all the detailed policy first. We released some data that there was no good reason not to release, and then started to tune the policy by looking at some harder cases. I did once try to do a more comprehensive policy statement, but when I put it to some departments for comment, all the Whitehall weasel words of, you know, where appropriate, to the extent that is justified, you know, subject to other priorities, you know, as resources and other constraints allow, and came in. You know. So what we have done in the Transparency Board is articulate a set of public data principles about some of the modalities of releasing data which don't have those weasel words in them. So you shouldn't have to register in order to get the data. The government shouldn't ask you what you want to do with this data. And if you want, you know, if you want to commit a crime with it, well, a crime's a crime. You know, a crime's criminal. And it's that constrains the use of the data. You shouldn't try and release that in thing. Something which is still a slightly warm issue on real-time train running information. That's how the compensation scheme works. The UK has been, unlike a lot of other jurisdictions, the licensing of Crown copyright material is not delegated to individual departments in most cases. So the National Archives, the Office of Public Sector Information there, they already had what was known as a click-use license, where if you wanted to use Crown copyright material, you'd go to a website and say, I agree to these terms and conditions, and you'd get a license screen that you could print out. And we worked with them to actually just have an open government license that you were deemed to have accepted by taking the data. So you don't have to register for it or apply for it. It's just there. It's very similar to Creative Commons, but it also covers database right and covers a small number of things that governments worry about. So you can't take the royal crest out of a government document under the Open Government License and then use that separately to say royally approved. Incremental delivery has been important in this. Don't try and do everything at once, and create a sort of flow of cases going through that you can always point to new stuff coming on. That helps actually with the news flow, because you've got There's only a limited amount that people can notice at once. It's meant that some of the harder cases we can postpone and come back to when you've got more precedents. This was the alpha version of data.gov, and generally while we had that, we didn't add new data to it. And then when we launched it publicly, we collected up nearly 2,000 more data sets. So it just leapt up. In fact, it was sort of accumulating up through here, but we didn't actually release it onto the site. It turned out not to be just about releasing new data. There was a lot of data that was published, but not in a reusable format. So locked into PDFs. And one of the early heroes of this process was the Home Office. Not a notoriously transparent government department, as government departments go, but someone in the Home Office went round people who had produced reports and said, "This table in your report, how did you do it?" And they said, "Oh, we've got this spreadsheet." And she said, "All right, I'd like to publish the spreadsheet." And they couldn't think of a reason why not. So they put it on the website. And that was, someone mentioned the Asbarometer data. That's where the Asbo data came from, which previously had been in just printed tables. There was data that was published, but with some form of restricted license. So you couldn't actually do much with it, particularly commercial reuse. Data that was only aimed at specialist groups. So there was quite a lot of interesting collation of data in the data for neighbourhood renewal collection, where they'd brought this data together, they curated it. And if you were working in neighbourhood renewal, you knew that data was there. But no one else knew it was there, and it was sort of hidden well away. So bring that out into a wider audience. Again, quite a bit of the statistics data was like that. Data that was previously only available for payment. Data that was only available in response to requests. They would give it, but you know, unless you knew who to ask. Right. And sometimes just data that was difficult to find. You know, it was not well described. There was no metadata about it. So data.gov.uk contains a lot of data which nobody knew was already published. Tim Berners-Lee in the TED talk said, you know, people hug their database, they don't want to let it go, you've no idea of the number of excuses people come up with to hang on to it. Well, after a period of working in this, I certainly had some idea of the number of excuses. My personal list has over 40, some people claim over 100 on their list. I particularly liked the one, "We know the data's wrong." There's one reason, so we shouldn't put it out. "We know the data's wrong, and people will tell us where it's wrong." "We know the data's wrong, and we will waste valuable resources inputting the corrections to it." It's not completely mad, because it may be, you know, that's passed, or there's already a corrective process that's cleaning up that data. People will construct league tables from it. Apparently, a few years back, the Department for Education used to publish the school's exam results strictly in alphabetical order to stop league tables being drawn up. And the newspapers used to have bring in teams of people to work through the night to key this in so it could be sorted into a league table. Actually, releasing data is a new idea. And often officials think, well, we've never done this before. We don't know why we've not done it before. But the fact it hasn't been done before, there must be a good reason why it hasn't been done before. So let's try and think of a good reason. So try and help them through it, look to ways to manage the, you know, perceived risks, examples and precedents where it's been done in other jurisdictions or the like. Sometimes we've been prepared to compromise on the data content, you know, which columns would be put out. So if there's a privacy angle to it, don't take the risk. You know, say, right, we'll take that column out for now because we're not sure about whether it can be properly anonymized or whatever. But don't compromise on the license terms. And once you start allowing data owners to start putting conditions in on how their data is used, you kill the economic goose that lays golden eggs. Hack days can show the potential benefits. Again, in the Home Office, one of the tipping points in the Home Office, we're actually getting some developers in to the Home Office for a few days and allow allowing them access to some of the Home Office's data and showing Home Office policy officials what could be done on this quickly. And the policy officials were absolutely bowled over by this. You know, they had no idea this sort of thing interesting to them and could be very supportive of their wider policies, such as the police, the crime maps and the neighbourhood policing and the like, could be done with their data. And frankly, with their IT systems, it couldn't be done with their data. And ensuring data owners get credit for what they will release. Unprompted by me, David Cameron, in his initial launch, was very good in managing the expectations. You know, this is a small start, but eventually it will make a big difference. It won't be perfect, it won't be in the most convenient format, and there may be some mistakes, but we're going to get on with it, and we're not going to wait until it's perfect. This is a sort of uncovering of data and sort of learning from it. We take in data from the official statistics hub, where departments are supposed to put metadata of any official statistics they release, and that's automatically uploaded into data.gov.uk. And within 24 hours of this being turned on, there was chatter on Twitter, because in the National Rail Travel Survey, there are two data files. And the first one takes you to the Great Britain production of bacon and ham statistics. And this is a metadata error that is present on the official statistics hub as well. So we just imported the metadata. And indeed, the agreement with the national statistician was that we would not touch this metadata at all, because the metadata was part of the official statistics. This error had been on the statistics hub for over a year, since this database was originally created. When we then did a sort of look at what else was coming in, there were some links to data on the official statistics hub that we'd imported, which not only 404'd, but had never worked on the internet, because actually there were links to that data on the originating department's intranet. So, you know, it just didn't have a proper domain name. It couldn't be resolved. We've done a lot of work with young rewired state and rewired state and those people. And it's the applications, not the data. You know, the data's just the means to an end. And it's not just an IT project. You know, the CIOs can give a bit of leadership, but generally the CIOs and the IT directors in government departments don't own this data. They're just sort of custodians of it, but they can't authorise its release. And yet the policymakers and the business owners love to categorise things, oh, this is an IT issue. So we get the IT director running around doing it, even though he can't authorise it. Try to keep the IT simple, use a good bit of almost entirely open source, actually, including the CCAN metadata repository from the Open Knowledge Foundation, used a lot of existing contracts and infrastructure with niche firms, and some departments said, oh, well, you know, we can't publish this data because the file is larger than 10 megabyte maximum that our web server allows. So out came the government credit card and opened an account on Amazon Web Services. And that's where the data was put. In the end, I put the Treasury coins data on Amazon Web Services and told the Treasury I would charge them for hosting it. But when after a year the hosting charge for 24 million rows, which had been downloaded quite a lot, all that, was $71. And the transaction cost of the Cabinet Office of raising an invoice and accepting a payment is about £100. I said it was probably better just to bear the cost of the $71. And the revealed legacy data issues actually create the spur for improvement. You know, anyone who tells me, oh, well, we ought to delay releasing this while we clean up the data, and I say, how much cleaning up of this data have you done in the last 20 years? It's actually getting this out there that creates the spur for improvement. And this has been about overcoming obstacles practically by doing, not by debating. Some wider implications. I've talked a bit about, you know, the right to data, Freedom 2.0, Freedom of Information Act 2.0. There's a white paper due in the spring, which will take some of this forward. And the government's announced setting up a public data group to bring some greater rationality for the residual paid-for data, which is normally data which the government doesn't actually collect for its own purposes. It collects purely for the purpose of a sale. On delivery end, we need to do more on improving the data quality, industrialise some of those release processes, and move those upstream so we've got a better idea of what data's being held, and move on data standards. Big finding is that government is a data user too. And some of the most avid customers of this data is other government agencies, or in some cases, other people in the same agency. Greater Manchester have got an open data site covering 10 local agencies, local authorities, fire, police and health. Estimated that there was an administrative cost of about $8.5 million a year savable of people in the Greater Manchester Public Services searching for information or negotiating access to it in order to take decisions or to make better informed public policy. That was an administrative cost. It's not the opportunity cost of taking the wrong decision because you couldn't get hold of the data. And so that sort of visibility of what else is happening in the area is something we see quite frequently. And we see this in various tiers of local government, that previously they haven't managed to negotiate access to the data, and suddenly it's on the website and some other authority in the area can have a look at it. And what's tending to happen is that people look at another authority's data, which may be about another service that interacts, and that tells them something about how these services work together. And that could be then the basis for a policy or a operational improvement approach. Like I said, we can see you've got this problem, we've got this problem, can we work together in this sort of way? Location, even more important than we thought it was, say, in the UK location strategy, that the way locational attributes, geospatial attributes in data allowed data in different data sets to be brought together. And classic mashup territory. The government is a key provider of reference data to the wider economy, something that the advisory panel on public sector information started to call the national information infrastructure. So it's things like company numbers, addresses, national insurance numbers, although that's not open data clearly, but those sorts of things. And yet the government has no real sense of the importance of these numbers to the wider functioning of society and the economy. And work on this is starting to bring this out, and this is probably where we lead on some of the semantic web uses in open data, by having really well thought through URIs for these core reference data in the economy and the entities within there. So there's work going on in Companies House, which have a proper URI scheme that allows you to unambiguously denote a company, which the government needs for its own purposes in order to be able to link up all that spending data to find out how much we really do spend with IBM. And the Berners-Lee sort of five-star quality. And I think there's much more work to be done in government itself on the benefits of linked data internally. All these cases that government finds it easier to ask for the data again rather than get it out of some other database. And Tim Berners-Lee and Nigel Shadbolt, it was announced in November, going to be the directors of an open data institute that the government is funding. Turns out to be in Shoreditch this time, to help develop business capability in this. So it's funded by through the Technology Strategy Board to start working on some of the supply chain issues, helping public sector to use the data more effectively, and some of these sort of linked data issues there, and keeping the academic research going in this area, and the data quality I've talked about. But the database of bus stops were geocoded, 300,000 of them. 18,000 of them were wrongly geocoded, and one of the ones close to me was in the middle of a lake. which is pretty obvious when you looked at the route on the map. But the lake, yeah, just move the lake, and some work using that data, the OpenStreetMap, and it's now got that sorted back. And this was something. This was a screenshot in Hull as they started to work on sorting this out in Hull. Some of them were surveyed. Some of them were sort of hand estimated on a map. Some of it was transcribing errors. Sometimes they just picked they accurately geocoded the wrong bus stop. But it had been done originally. The geocoding had been done, and the national dataset had been built in order that the Transport Direct journey planner could be built. Because previously the bus operators hadn't needed it, and the local authorities, the bus stops hadn't needed it. But when you have to do a journey planner, and you can put in a postcode, which then tells you at the start of your journey, to find out which is the correct bus stop to walk to, you need that geographical information, which is why it was done, but also why it was not that sensitive to errors at about the 5% level. That, you know, 95% of that mode of journey planning sort of went okay, and indeed probably more frequently used bus stops got cleaned up by the old process. Nothing to do with the government at the moment, although Met Office are now quite interested in using this. This is something called UK Snow. And the idea is that you tweet your postcode a number out of 10 to how heavily it is snowing, and the hashtag UK Snow, and someone's got a server that just monitors for tweets on that hashtag, works out the location, and puts it on the map, and there's a bit of a time delay associated with it. So if it notices, if you say there's some snow there, then the symbol sits there for a while, and then decays. And this was from last winter, sort of real-time band of snow going across southeastern central England. The Met Office are now very interested in this. They have a pilot taking this on. Right, final slide. This is something Nigel Shadbolt's leading on, which is, we talked about releasing government information to the public. What about the information people have on you? And should you have access to that information so you can do these sorts of things with it? And what's, this is my data, which is now with an I rather than a Y for some trademark reason, started out of the consumer choice that it is practically impossible to buy the best mobile phone tariff for you. At any point, there are about 12 million mobile phone tariffs to choose from. Most people's view of what their usage is not wholly accurate. And some studies have suggested that the average mobile phone user overpays by about £200 for their mobile phone. And yet, the mobile phone company that you are with has perfect data on your usage pattern. And the idea was, and this is known as data keys originally, was that you should be able to take that bundle of data and give it to someone else, or not, but give it to someone else, who may be another supplier, maybe mobile phone provider, or you do the same with meter energy consumptions and the like, and say, make me an offer, and this is my usage data. Or you can put it into some form of price comparison website, which would work that out for you, or not. It's your data, it's data about you, so it's your data to do what you want with. The various sort of various companies involved in this are interestingly conflicted, because it's a matter of the judgment of whether you're going to gain or lose from But anyway, this is it seems to have some legs. But it's also raised the question of is this something that the government should be doing about the data it holds on you? And should you have much more practical and easy to exercise rights to get at that data? And some of the technological issues are in common. The government's announced it's going to work towards allowing you to have more access to your medical records. It's a particular problem within government, where a lot of the data sharing is done by bulk data transfers periodically. So by the time a correction goes in, the wrong data may have been disseminated. Plus, of course, there are problems of then the credibility of changes to the data. So it is really, really bad news to be recorded by the government, and particularly DWP, as dead. Because someone who's recorded as dead, who then phones to try and change their records, is immediately assumed to be a fraudster. And DWP death data, death markers, are then distributed quite widely into other systems. So bad news. That's the end of my slides.